Studio 360.
Okay, it's the back seat. Girl with balloon, ladies and gentlemen, standing in the back of the room. And I'm going to start getting here 100, 150, 200,000. I have already.
A few weeks ago, as you probably heard, something extraordinary happened at a Sotheby's art auction. It happened when a work by the anonymous, mysterious British artist Banksy went up for sale.
What happened was the piece was in a big artist's frame, and we were told we couldn't take off the frame, that the frame was part of the work, which happens quite a bit, where, like, the frame is actually part of the, you know, infrastructure or institutional overlay the artist wants to give the work of art for you to understand it a certain way.
That's Amy Capolazzo, who chairs the Fine Arts Division at Sotheby's. She is based in New York, but was in London for that auction.
Last chance. And selling for $860,000.
But it turns out it had a paper shredder in it, and the canvas, the image on the front, sort of slid down up once a remote was triggered, and it came down and sort of shredded and half shredded.
People are laughing and joking and looking around, turning like something happened or something fell down. Everybody didn't believe that it was real. And that was the great thing, that we came out thinking it's a joke.
So this new piece of art that somebody just bought for $1.4 million was vandalized by the artist, just short of destroyed by the artist. Think about that. If somebody won a bid on a yacht, but before he could sail it away, the thing was deliberately sunk, that sale would be null and void. But this Banksy prank is art, and shredding half the painting probably made it worth more.
We had numerous, like too numerous to count, requests to buy the work because it was like part of art history. Of course, the buyer who bought it had the first choice to buy it.
And of course, that buyer did go through with the sale because now she or he had dibs on an historic and special piece of contemporary art. But the episode prompted the rest of us to have a big think about what words like value even mean when it comes to art nowadays. As luck would have it, there is a very good new documentary on HBO that grapples with this very question. The Price of Everything, it's called, and it goes inside both the creative and financially speculative zones of the art world. Amy Capolazzo figures prominently in the film. And when Amy and the director of The Price of Everything, Nathaniel Kahn, joined me in the studio the other day, Nathaniel also had the Banksy shredding stunt on his mind.
It's definitely a comment on, I mean, I think as always, his art so often is mm-hmm. commentary on where we are as a culture, and that he can shred part of the painting, and it still, in fact, not only retains value, becomes more valuable. Yep. This is very much something that we wanted to look at in the film, which is, you know, the question of how we value things
yes.
and why we value things, and that ultimately art is, in the end, it holds a mirror up to who we are as a culture right now, and that we are in a world in which everything is for sale.
So, Nathaniel, explain what The Price of Everything is and is about.
The movie is about the contemporary art world, and it's about the complex relationship between art and money. That's been a fraught relationship since the very beginning of time, and now at this moment, it is perhaps more fraught and certainly more exciting than it's ever been before.
Your documentary that brought you to my attention and to the world's attention, my architect, about your father, the great architect Louis Kahn, was there a thing, a moment, a eureka, aha moment that said, oh, I want to do this film?
Well, I grew up in a family of artists, so I always saw the relationship between art and money. That's always been something that I've sort of experienced firsthand in the difficulties of that. So I always sort of, my sense is coming from the end of the artist. But then seeing in the last few years the way art has, you know, really grabbed the headlines, partly for its the run-up of prices
yes.
in the art world.
Listeners, he looked at Amy as he's talked about the run-up
of
prices.
Of course, because she's, you know, an incredible person and also an incredible person in this film.
Amy, so when Nathaniel Kahn comes to you and says, I'm making this movie. Did you think, Amy, that, oh, I get it, you're going to cast me as the villain of this piece?
I just sort of thought, look, a lot of things get made about the art world that go into sort of the dustbin of the art world's own narcissistic, self-reflective story. So I was like, you know, I'm sure I'll, you know, I had no idea what that meant. It could have been a 2-second cameo or something, no idea. So I said, you know, principally, okay. And I wasn't so keen on it at the moment it came to pass. And then when I heard Nathaniel was going to be the director, I loved the movie My Architect, so I thought, okay, this is a quality practitioner here. We should be in pretty safe hands. So I said yes, and then I didn't. They came to film me one day, and I'm doing my job in the movie. It's not particularly...
But that's the exciting thing for us. I mean, as a filmmaker, that was the thrilling part. You know, the death for me is having to do an interview. I can't stand interviews because, you know, you lock somebody in there. And it's one thing to talk the way we're talking now. But with a film crew here and you have lights and you kind of put somebody on a mark or in a chair, suddenly everything's dead.
It's why we call them talking heads.
Exactly, talking heads. You know, great band, but not great necessarily for making really a film that gets in deeply into something. Yeah. So for me, the cinema verite part of it is what I love. Really being able to observe somebody, be with somebody when they're doing what they do.
So this will be the catalog for the Ames collection. Did you land that deal?
Yeah, Stephen and Ann Ames. We don't get things of this caliber very often, so that makes it special. There's also a lot at stake.
You happen to be this incredible room downstairs, you know, sort of in the back, the back part of the auction house where all the art is kind of around. And suddenly we're sort of in this warehouse, storehouse of art, talking about art, putting together this catalog, and it's a part of the world. I know it's every day for you, but for most of us to see how an auction is put together is completely fascinating.
Okay, so this is a really interesting picture. This, we just hit it. This is like a money shot. When you have the painting you're selling, and then a picture of the artist standing in front of the painting, Bill de Kooning, winner.
Holy grail of comps.
Holy grail of comps. That's as good as it gets.
And it collides these two worlds that we wanted to investigate, the world of art and commerce, is coming together, clashing together in this really remarkably visual way, which was thrilling.
You interview a bunch of big-time art people, painters like Jeff Koons and briefly Gerhard Richter, and dealers and collectors and critics. So the ones who became the main characters of the film, And maybe they were all as instantly bedazzling as Amy Capalazzo, but did that happen organically?
We kind of realized fairly early that there were sort of three areas that we wanted to deal with. Of course, the making of art, the selling of art, and the buying of art, or, you know, the collecting of art. But to find a collector like Stefan Edlis,
who's this 90-year-old Holocaust survivor and plastics mogul and big-time art collector.
There's a lot of money kicking around, and there is a limit to where you can put it. To be an effective collector, deep down, you have to be shallow. You have to be a decorator. You want the thing to work with the rugs, if you want it to work with the furniture.
The moment I met him, I also knew, and of course Amy and Stefan knew each other, so suddenly this becomes something where this is a cast of characters, as in a great drama, who already have relationships. And if one is able to observe those relationships and bring them together somewhere later in the film, now the film begins to have a structure.
Look at this one, Steph. This is a good little picture.
Red is always good. So the early rules, red is better than brown. Brown's pictures are unsaleable. And don't buy any pictures with fish.
Brown is hard. Green is not always great. This is de Kooning in front of the painting I'm selling.
Oh. You don't have to be an art collector to be able to buy de Kooning. You look at this, you listen to her, and pretty soon you know, okay, that's something I can buy. Whether you need it or like it, it's a good investment.
Well, and he both obviously is acutely aware of the price of everything he's ever owned or owns now and how he did financially, but he clearly cares about the work as well. Is that combination uncommon in the breed?
So I really hate it, or I hate it's too strong, I don't really care, but when people think that somehow because I know the value of works of art, or in this case we're talking about Stefan, who was very acutely aware of the value of the trading value of things, that it somehow alters or corrupts your other relationship to it. To know the value of a work of art or to know its commercial value at a given moment doesn't necessarily change or corrupt your love, affection, like or dislike for an object. It's really just another way to know something.
I still resist that. I mean,
but there's a value judgment inherent in your comment of like, do all these people, like, do they really love the art? Or do they just know the value?
Yes, yeah. There is a value judgment because I've met a lot of art collectors and see some of them, other than Stefan depicted in Nathaniel's film, who, you know, aren't as sincerely delighted by owning works of art.
So this gets into a very fundamental thing. Like, I always feel that it is morally wrong to judge how someone loves something because it's kind of none of my business. And I'm not really, I mean, you know, maybe we should tell them to, like, I don't know, their children better or something. Like, it's not my job or my place to comment how someone loves something.
No, it's mine.
Okay, right, exactly. So you might editorialize that, but I feel a little bit like, if you don't express your love in the way that I express my love, you must not have love.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So I don't really like that side of things, and I try not to get into the morality of that because I think it's a dead-end street.
Right.
And I think it's kind of liberal posturing in a certain way.
So Nathaniel, you do a bit of history giving context for people about, oh, there was this famous sale in the 70s where suddenly, wow, everybody woke up and contemporary art was worth that new paradigm continued and blew up more in the 80s, and here we are, right?
Well, I think the way Amy states it, though, in the film is probably more accurate, which is there was a key moment, which was the skull sale. It you know, it surely wasn't the first time.
1973.
Right.
And, you know, when Robert Skull, the taxi fleet owner who had a piece of a gallery called the Green Gallery, and he knew the artist directly. He bought directly from the artists. And the artists thought he loved them. I mean, right? Artists want to be loved, right? And, you know, they want their piece to communicate to you. So if you buy something from an artist, especially if you're saying, hey, can you give me a deal? The artist somehow thinks, oh, he really...
You've adopted my child.
He or she really loves this piece. That's they right. want to live with it.
Yeah.
So the artist, you know, shares their pieces with Robert Skull. And then several years later, Robert Skull turns around and does an auction of 50 pieces. And we luckily, there's incredible footage of this sale.
Record numbers of art dealers, collectors, and connoisseurs filed into the Park Burnett Gallery for what was billed as the most important auction of post-World War II American art.
All 50 works by mostly living artists, contemporary artists, sold at auction at then Park Burnett, now Sotheby's, and brought in, what was it, $2.3 million, something like this, which at
what
that
was an enormous amount,
enormous amount of money for living artists. So then there's that seminal moment, that key moment, that awkward embrace between Robert Rauschenberg.
He looks like he's ready to throw Skull a punch. Really.
He does. Mm-hmm. He does, and he does in fact throw Skull a kind of he hits him on the shoulder,
a little jab. Yeah.
Says, Christ, sir, you need to send me flowers.
Send you flowers? Nothing happened. Where? For what? I should have anyway.
There's a great markup.
So he bought something for maybe $600, and he'd sold it for, you know, $85,000 suddenly at auction, and Rauschenberg felt ripped off, okay, and cheated. But there's an emotional cheating there. But then Skull says,
how about yours that you're going to sell now? I've been working for you, too. We work for each other.
So what Skull was saying there back in the 70s is that by selling high, he's driving up the prices of new work that Rauschenberg and other big artists would make and sell going forward.
And there's this awkward hug. Okay, this awkward hug for me is the core of this movie. It's this awkward embrace between art and money. Why is it we have this problem with the relationship between art and money? It's not so simple. There is this sense we want the artist to be pure, and the artist actually needs to be pure in the sense that the moment they start thinking about the market and will something sell or won't it sell, they're screwed. It's over. If that's what you're thinking about, instead of some channeling your inner, you know, your inner muse, you're screwed. So anyway, so that awkward embrace really is something that we look at from lots of different angles in this film.
I sort of remember that nearly every scene you shot somehow ended up somehow in the film. But I did remember one scene that I thought, curious omission. So we're in the back storeroom going through the catalog and the proof, and the works of art are all behind us. It's our, like, storage vault for works of art. And I walk over at one point and I look at something that might be worth $5,000 on a great day. And I talk about the virtue of it and why I love this kind of piece so much. You remember that scene?
I blocked it out.
Oh, you did? Okay. So it was more convenient for me to be a different kind of character in this film.
I know. What was the piece? Do you remember?
I do remember. And I'll...
You won't say.
You know, I talk about why I love this object and what this artist's merits are to me in lots of ways. but it's an object that isn't worth very much at all.
Sure.
But the idealistic art-loving you was not, in that instance, was not included in the film.
That was
okay, so, but here's something about filmmaking. It was very clear to me that I did absolutely need to represent that aspect of you, which is how much you love art.
Yes. I don't feel cheated. Don't get me wrong.
No, but we had to have a moment because that is part of you, and it would be completely inaccurate to represent it otherwise. So, but that moment couldn't happen then. It had to happen later.
Right.
And the moment also was much, much stronger with you in the back of the car.
What was the first piece that you fell in love with?
Like, beyond something I made as a child that I loved, or, you know, like something that was real art in that way.
She saw, yeah.
My hometown museum has this Giacomo Balla painting that's very famous, and it's a dog, a little kind of like long-haired dachshund, like wagging its tail and like its feet are going, and a woman's dress is moving, and it's that movement, that very futurist movement of Balla. It's a famous picture. Masterpiece, loved that.
But this is when you were a kid.
Right.
Before you knew anything about the market or anything else, you loved art.
Right.
So that becomes such an interesting story because now it's you going to a museum, you having access to this thing as a kid.
Well,
right?
I would just like to say, I'd like to dispel the myth that the people who work all day in the trading end of the marketplace don't love the product. Because if we were all really just attracted to trading, I suppose we would have gone to Wall Street. But
right,
really,
of course.
Everybody who came into the art world, everybody who came into the gallery system or the auction house system came for the love of art. And so you never leave that. I mean, believe me, it's what gets you out of bed on bad days. Just like you love
but
writing.
This is so important because you use the word love. That is what interests me in this film. That everyone in this film loves art. There's no question. They love it in different ways. And I'm also not here to judge love. And love can happen any way that love happens is a good thing. That's how I see it.
Right.
But I do also see that I do think that some of the marketplace is not about love. It's more about money. And I do see that we've used words like value.
Uh-huh.
And we've corrupted words like value and luxury and to be monetary. I mean, when we use the word value, we should be using the word price.
Right.
Value is something that's much, much broader. Mm-hmm. Art does have an intrinsic value.
Worthy. It means worthy.
Well,
yeah.
Something that has something, yeah,
excellent beyond its monetary
right.
value.
Right. Right. But something that lasts. Something that is ineffable. Something mm-hmm. that you actually can't possess.
I've had this conversation a couple of times in my career with
with
very serious collectors, this particular conversation,
okay.
where somebody bought something that was very valuable and maybe paid a world record price or something that was like a little bit of a stretch in every way. Like it was an astonishing moment for maybe the grandness of the moment or something. And it's a moment of great possession. Like you bought it, you won it, you're the winning bid, boom, hammer goes, it's yours, you want it. And a couple of times I've had conversations where I've said to people who seem to be Maybe they love the monetary side or the conquest side of having captured it is the part that's the most seductive at that moment. I said, well, you know, you don't really own that piece. Like, I know you're about to pay $32,681,000 for it, but you don't really own it. You're kind of like just a custodian of it for a little while. And maybe you should look at it like being a foster parent. Like, your job is to just take care of it for a while and take care of it well. And maybe you'll be morally judged based on how well you cared for it over
you
time.
You said all this?
Yeah, I say that to clients all the time.
Good for you. Tough love.
So you do push people.
I don't know if that's pushing people. I'm just reminding them, like, you just bought something that was 80 years old. And if you're really lucky, if you care for it very well, it will outlive all of us and our children and our children's children and everybody after that.
So, Nathaniel, talk about the title of your film, The Price of Everything. What do you mean by that?
You know, the whole quote is from Oscar Wilde, that a cynic is a person who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. So under that definition, we might say we live in it's a cynical society that knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. I think one real key for us in making this film is we'd like to try to disconnect those two worlds and those two words. What kind of world do we want to live in? What do we really value? What is the meaning of value? What does price have to do with value? Those are things we have to look at as a society.
Well, thank you, Nathaniel, because you have asked and answered my final question, which was exactly that. This is just what's happened to American society in the last 35, 40 years, where the market is all And those other values that we still sometimes kind of sort of pretend to care about have been a little overwhelmed and swamped.
Yeah, well, as always, art reflects who we are at this moment. And ultimately, the best art, the greatest art, will reflect our time for the future. And, you know, this movie, I was very conscious in making the movie that this is not just speaking to people who already know all this stuff. For me, I hope that the film, and for all of us who made the film, we'd also sort of like to show a little bit of the playbook. This is kind of how the market works. And it's good to understand that. It's not glorifying it. It's not judging it. But this is who we are right now. But one wants to throw this out to the artists out there. Artists give us hope. They speak for who we are right now. We must not only support them, but we can't undermine them also by creating a system that is demoralizing and that constantly says that, well, art is all about the money. Because it's not. In the end, it is not about the money.
Wait. What's demoralizing? Like, to make your work as a woman in the 1960s where there was absolutely no prospect whatsoever of financial compensation, and you still made your work, I mean, there's nothing more demoralizing than that.
Oh, no, I agree with you.
So I would say we're in a golden age. Just like as Schimmel says, there's not a golden age without gold, but there is actually the prospect that you could make it now more than ever before. And that's exciting. And it's exciting not just to... You know, it's exciting to everyone, and it's not just a certain select group of white male artists. I mean, I see many artists of color succeeding,
sure.
Many women, many more opportunities. That doesn't mean everybody will get to the zenith on
it
high.
It is the best of times and the worst of times, as I like to say.
Ah, oh, that's the right.
Well said.
Amy Capilazzo and Nathaniel Kahn, this has been such a great pleasure, beyond my wildest expectations and hopes of what we could do here in discussing this subject. Thanks.
Thank you.
Amy Capilazzo is chair of fine art at Sotheby's, and Nathaniel Kahn's documentary, The Price of Everything, premieres on HBO on November 12th.